If you would, turn with me to Matthew 12, verses 38 and 40. We're going to read in there, Matthew 12, 38 and 40. As you well know, most of the Christian world right now is celebrating the Good Friday, Easter, or as they're starting to call it, the Resurrection Sunday weekend. And they do so believing that they're honoring Jesus as the Messiah. But as we see here in Matthew 12, verses 38 through 40, Jesus gave only one sign that he was the Messiah. Let's go ahead and read that. Matthew 12, verse 38. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." The title of my sermon today is 3 Days, Three Nights. Because we firmly believe that this sign that Jesus gave, 3 days and three nights, literally means a full 72 hours that he would be in the grave. We have no doubt about that, and we can demonstrate that. But the Easter tradition, going from a Friday sunset to a Sunday morning resurrection, begs the question, asks the question, well, wait a minute, how do you get 3 days and three nights from a Friday sunset to Sunday dawn? So today what I'd like to do is take a look at that common tradition and demonstrate why it is not biblically supported. Now, how do people reconcile the fact that Jesus said he was going to be in the grave 3 days and three nights with this tradition of him being buried Friday evening and rising Sunday morning? Well, most people don't even think about it. They just blindly accept what they've been taught and give it no further thought. Some state that, well, Matthew is the only one who specifically stated this 3 days and three nights. The other gospel writers didn't include that, so it must not be that important, so we can overlook it. That's just the beginning. Some believe that the Bible is in error. William Barclay, who in most cases is a very respected, fairly well-known commentator, in his series, The New Daily Bible Study, on the book Gospel of Matthew, in referring to Matthew 12, 38, and 40, he writes the following. It is to be noted that these are not the words of Jesus, but the explanation of Matthew. The fact is that Matthew understood wrongly the point of what Jesus said, and in doing so, he made a strange mistake. For Jesus was not in the heart of the earth for three nights, but only for two. He was laid in the earth on the night of Good Friday and rose on the morning of the first Easter Sunday. We see here how this strong adherence to this tradition prohibits people from looking at the Bible objectively. They have to support their tradition. Now, the rest of the people, in trying to explain this unexplainable, in trying to reconcile the sign with what their beliefs are, resort to a claim that, well, the Jews reckoned time differently back then, and the expression 3 days and three nights is not something that we should take literally. It's an idiomatic expression. It's something that doesn't really mean a full 3 days. It's just an expression of the time. So basically what they're claiming is that any part of a day can be thought of as the full 24 hours. So for example, in their view, with Christ being buried right before sunset on Friday, that little smidgen of time actually counts for the whole 24 hours going all the way back to sunset on Thursday. So that gives them their first night and their first day right there. That's how they reconcile this. Doesn't make sense. And you might ask, well, how do they justify this type of reasoning? What do they turn to show that that's a valid explanation? Well, the teaching that the part of a day can count as a whole 24 hours actually comes from a rabbinic discussion in the Talmud. In the Talmud, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, who lived sometime around the first century AD, wrote the following. A day and night, he says, a day and night are an ona, which they view as a unit of time. And the portion of an ona is as the whole of it. That was written in the Jerusalem Talmud and also in the Babylonian Talmud. So, okay, you're sitting here wondering, an ona? What is an ona? Well, an ona is a Hebrew word, O-N-A-H. And the discussion of this as a period of time comes from the Talmud. It does not come from the Bible. In fact, that word is used only one time in the Bible, and let's take a look at where that is used. Turn with me to Exodus 21 and verse 10. Exodus 21:10 is the only place in the Bible where the Hebrew word ona appears. Let's read here. Exodus 21:10. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. Quiz time here. Where do you see the definition of the length of the day in this verse? You don't. Matter of fact, the word ona is the word that is translated into marriage. Brown's Driver Briggs Hebrew Definitions defines ona as cohabitation, conjugal rights. Basically, what we see here is that ona refers to a woman's rights and a husband's responsibilities within the marital relationship. It has nothing to do with defining the length of a day or a night. As if that was shaky enough, or wasn't shaky enough, in going back and quoting Rabbi Azariah, basically what people are doing in trying to use this as support for their tradition is they're actually taking one Jewish side versus the other side. Because there was not a consensus among the rabbis as to what this ona meant. There is a huge discussion. Bishop John Lightfoot, writing back in the 1600s, states the following. But how much is the space of an ona? Rabbi Yochanan said either a day or a night. Notice it's not a day and a night. It's either a day or it's a night. And so also the Jerusalem Talmud. Rabbi Akiva fixed a day for an ona and a night for an ona. But the tradition is that Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah said a day and a night make an ona, and part of an ona is as a whole. And a little after, Rabbi Ishmael computeth a part of the ona for the whole. So what we see here is these rabbis are discussing what ona means. They at least have an agreement that, well, if you've got part of this time period, you can consider it as the whole time period. What they did not agree on, though, was what that time period was. The majority of the rabbis, that it's only 12 hours. It was the minority opinion that says, well, it's 24 hours. But that is the opinion that the Easter apologists have latched onto to explain their own beliefs. So let's take a look at this. The summary of how they use the word ona to justify the Friday to Sunday time frame. We see that the statement that by Jewish reckoning, this is how they determined time back then, that Friday night to Sunday morning would equal 3 days and three nights, it's just wrong. It's inaccurate and it doesn't apply. Number one, why doesn't it apply? The rabbinic definition of ona is never used as a substitute for the typical use of day and night. Secondly, the laws of ona, as they were discussing, pertain to a wife's rights and a husband's responsibilities within their marriage relationship. It's not talking about defining a day and a night. Thirdly, there wasn't even agreement on what this meant. There was disagreement. And the majority opinion says, no, it's 12 hours. The minority opinion said it's 24. The rabbinic discussion of ona doesn't even apply to Jonah. And because that's the sign that Jesus used, consequently, it does not apply to Jesus' situation, the amount of time that he was to be in the grave. And when Jesus gave that sign, he didn't state he was going to be in the grave 4 onas or 5 onas or 6 onas. He used the common expression day and night. The people understood that when he said day and night, it meant a full day and a full night. And of course, he said it was 3. So, by using the rabbinic debate over the length of an ona, it's actually a deceptive argument, and it's invalid proof for the Good Friday, Sunday morning tradition. And the irony of it is that the Roman Church, as one of the reasons for moving away from observing the Sabbath, was that they didn't want to Judaize their observations. They didn't want to be considered as Jews. And yet, what have they done? They have gone back to Jewish writings to justify their observance of Easter. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So how does the Bible define what a day is? Let's start taking a look at that. Let's take a look at Luke 13. We'll be looking at verses 32 through 33. Luke 13, verses 32 and 33. Jesus is speaking here, and he's talking in the context of counting days. And of course, when you're counting days, you're using an ordinal number, a number that represents order, a sequence. Jesus states here in Luke 13, 32, and he said to them, "Go tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons, perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. Nevertheless, I must journey today, tomorrow, and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside of Jerusalem." What we see here is that this passage does demonstrate that the Bible uses what is called inclusive reckoning. And we do that ourselves today, too. What we see here is that we start counting, well, today is the first day we're doing something, tomorrow is the second day, and the day after tomorrow is the third day. That's fine. But inclusive reckoning does not produce exact time references. So what the writers in the Bible did, or the speakers in the case of Jesus, when they wanted to specify a particular period of time, they stated 3 days and 3 nights. That is a specific period of time. It's not saying third day. It tells you exactly the length of time that something is going to take place. Now, a lot of people will point to this and say, well, hey, look, he's using counting here. He's saying third day. So that matches perfectly with our belief, because Friday would be the first day, Saturday would be the second day, and Sunday's the third day. So they claim that this proves that the third day is the exact same thing as 3 days and three nights. And 3 days and three nights means only parts of 3 days and three nights. The problem with that argument, again, is that Jesus, in this passage, is using the word third. He's counting. Whereas in Matthew 12, he specifically said 3 days and three nights. And when you look at the Greek word that's translated into three, you can look everywhere it's used in the New Testament, and not once is there any evidence that that word means anything less than three. It doesn't mean parts of three. It's always talking about three whole units. So how does the Bible define a whole unit that pertains to a day? Again, the answer is clearly here. Jesus himself gave us that answer. If you turn with me to John, verse 11. Chapter 11 in John, verses 9 and 10. John 11, verses 9 and 10. Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." Clearly, Jesus is making a distinction between day and night here. And he states very obviously that a day is considered to be 12 hours. And consequently, although not explicitly stated here, that means the night would also equal 12 hours. So we see that when Jesus used the phrase 3 days and three nights, he meant 3 12-hour days and 3 12-hour nights. It doesn't require any particular twisting or straining to try to get that to match. That's the phrase that he used. But the supporters of Easter try to reason that part of a day can be a full 24 hours by using rabbinic teachings. And they say that third and three always mean the same thing, and they don't. The Bible just does not provide the evidence for that position. So let's go ahead and take a look at the events of his crucifixion and his resurrection and see how that does fit into the 3 days and three nights which he foretold. John 19:31. The first thing we notice here, John 19:31. Therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day. The Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Very first thing we notice here, that it was a preparation day. Now, a lot of people argue, oh, it's a preparation day. Had to be a Friday because the preparation day was always the day before the weekly Sabbath. But is that true? The Greek word, and I'm not going to try to pronounce it here, partly for my benefit, yours, and my wife's who's signing. The Greek word that's translated preparation here is defined in Thayer's Greek English Lexicon of the New Testament as the day on which the Jews made necessary preparation to celebrate a Sabbath or a feast. Likewise, in the New Unger's Bible Dictionary, they describe this word as, in the Jewish sense, the day of preparation was the day in which the Jews made the necessary preparation to celebrate a Sabbath or a festival. So it's clear that the preparation day was not just for the weekly Sabbath. Preparation day was also for the annual holy days. Now, did the Jews of the time treat annual holy days as Sabbaths? Yes, they did. As evidence for that, think about Pentecost. I know it's 7 weeks away here yet. Think about Pentecost. How do we count for Pentecost? God tells us to count from Shabbat. That's the Hebrew word that's used there in Leviticus 23. And yet, when you look in Leviticus 23, the first day of unleavened bread is not called Shabbat. So the counting is actually done from the weekly Sabbath, which pertains to the days of unleavened bread. But what do the Pharisees do? They count for Pentecost from the first day of unleavened bread. So for them, Pentecost always falls on the month of Sivan, sixth day, because they always count from the first day of unleavened bread. They treat it, view it, as Sabbath. So this is further evidence that the annual holy days were treated as Sabbaths, and they are very similar. We're not to do regular work, holy convocations. They're commandments. They're appointed feast times that God gave to us to observe. But it was treated as a Sabbath, so there was a preparation day prior to the first day of unleavened bread. So the statement that this preparation day has to be a Friday isn't true. So what happened on that preparation day? Well, around 3 o'clock, Jesus cries out, and he dies after being pierced by his spear in his side. Later, the soldiers come to break the legs because of what the Pharisees had asked, and they find that Jesus was already dead. Once he is dead, Joseph of Arimathea goes to Pilate and requests to have Jesus' body. Pilate's amazed. He says, what? He's dead already? Because typically, the bodies would hang there for days, an agonizing death. So Pilate wants confirmation. Centurion confirms that Jesus is dead. Pilate gives Joseph permission. Joseph then goes back, and with Nicodemus, takes the body down, prepares it a little bit, and lays it in the tomb. And the body is entombed around sunset. Notice also that the women who were with him were also there at the tomb around sunset to see where the body was laid. So now we begin the first night in the grave that Jesus spoke of. And this first night in the grave is the beginning of the high day that John referred to. Now here's another point of contention. A lot of people say, well, okay, it was an annual holy day, but it had to fall on the weekly Sabbath because that's the only time that the Jews used the word high day, was to give special indication that an annual holy day was falling on a weekly Sabbath. But again, that's not true. As you know, there are a number of observances throughout the years that the Jews would commemorate. But not all of them were days that were established by God. So the Jews used the phrase high day to differentiate those feast days that were established by God from their holy days, their holidays, such as Purim or Hanukkah, which were also annual observances. So again, you can't claim that just because it's high day means that the high day fell on a weekly Sabbath. So Jesus spends his first night in the grave. Day one dawns. It's the daylight portion of the first day of unleavened bread. Matthew 27. We see something going on here. Matthew 27, verses 62-64. The Pharisees are concerned. They're afraid that someone's going to come, sneak in there, take the body away, and then claim that Jesus did just exactly as he said. So on the daylight portion of the first day of unleavened bread, they come to Pilate. Matthew 27, verses 62-64. On the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered together to Pilate, saying, "Sir, we remember while he was still alive how that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise.' Therefore, command that the tomb be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away, and say to the people, 'He is risen from the dead.' So the last deception will be worse than the first." Now, a lot of people argue here because we have the expression "after 3 days," which is what Jesus had said, and the Pharisees are saying "the third day." And they'll say, "Well, see there. There you go. 3 days doesn't have to be a full 3 days because it's the same as third day." But a couple things that they forget here. Number one, this is now Nisan 15. Christ was crucified on the 14th. So when the Pharisees are talking about the third day, they're talking about the third day from the 15th. The claim is also that the Pharisees understood that Jesus meant parts of days. He didn't mean the full 72 hours. But again, that raises the question. Based on their interpretation of what Jesus said, then Jesus would be arising on the morning of Nisan 16th. But the Pharisees here are asking Pilate to have a guard placed on the 15th, which is the first day, the 16th, second day, and 17th, which is the third day. Why, if they understood him to mean only parts of days, would they be asking to have a guard on the tomb a full day after Jesus supposedly was going to rise? It doesn't make any sense. First day of unleavened bread comes to an end. We have the first night, first day in the grave. The second night in the grave, the Bible doesn't tell us any particular incidents. And now we come to day two. And that brings us to Mark 16:1. Mark 16:1. Now, when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices that they might come and anoint him. Okay, memorize that. Because now we're also going to take a look at Luke 23:56. So we have Mark 16:1 and Luke 23:56. Luke 23:56 states, "Then they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment." Now some speculate that the spices had already been bought beforehand. And consequently, what they're saying here is that the Sabbath which was passed, as we read in Mark 16:1, and the Sabbath they rested on, which we read in Luke, were the same Sabbath. Well, that doesn't seem likely. Number one, they would have had to have expected that Jesus was going to die. And in spite of the number of times that he told him that this was going to happen, they still did not fully realize that this was upon them, and they wouldn't have had time to go out and buy spices ahead of time. And as you remember, the women were at the tomb when Jesus was being laid in there. It's sunset. Sunset of the first day of unleavened bread was starting. They're not going to be going out on the holy day to buy spices. And they also are not going to be preparing those spices on the holy day. It's not what you do on a God's day, on God's appointed feast day. This was work. This was not a day of, the holy day was not a day to do this work. So they could not have bought the spices on the holy day, and they would not have prepared the spices on the holy day. So consequently, the only explanation that makes any sense is that they rested on the first day of unleavened bread. Then there was a working day. They went out, bought the spices, prepared the spices. And then, as Luke tells us, the weekly Sabbath began, and they rested on the weekly Sabbath according to the commandment. That's the only explanation which makes sense. So night number two and day number two are now finished as the sun is setting, and they're resting on the Sabbath. As they're resting on the Sabbath, the third night takes place. And the sun rises, and we begin the morning of the third day. It's still the weekly Sabbath. The sun makes its course across the sky, and at the end of that day, at sunset, was the end of the 72 hours, the 3 days, and the 3 nights that Jesus promised. And that brings us to Matthew 28, verse 1. Matthew 28, 1. Now, after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. Young's literal translation, first part of 28:1, translates it, and on the eve of the Sabbath at the dawn, toward the first of the Sabbaths. So what time frame is Matthew talking about here? Well, a lot of people look at this and they see the word dawn and they think, oh, must be right before morning. Well, first, let's look at the phrase, the end of the Sabbath. It's a Greek phrase, comes from apse de sabbaton. What this means is it's in the evening of or late on the Sabbath, or at the end of the Sabbath. Sabbaton is a plural word. So it's around sunset at the end of the weekly Sabbath. A.T. Robertson, in his Word Pictures of the New Testament, writes, "This careful chronological statement, according to the Jewish days, clearly means that before the Sabbath was over, that is, before 6 p.m., this visit by the women was made to see the sepulcher." Now, as I stated here, the Greek word sabbaton is used. It could indicate the time when two Sabbaths were completed, because there were in this week, at the day of the first day of unleavened bread and the weekly Sabbath. We're at sunset, so that both of those have come to an end. Sabbaton is also frequently translated as the word week, but it still holds true. Sabbath is the seventh day of the week, so as the Sabbath ends, so is the week coming to an end. That is when the women are coming to the sepulcher. They're coming to see the tomb. Now, what about dawn? Does that throw anybody off here? Does dawn mean the rising of the sun? Well, the general meaning of the word that is translated into dawn actually is the beginning of. And here we see a definite bias in the translations. And I want to show you what I'm talking about here. I want to read Matthew 28:1 from the New International Version. I want you to listen carefully to how they translate this. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week. And yet, back in Luke 23, verse 54, the exact same Greek word is used. And here's how they translate it there. It was preparation day, and the Sabbath was about to begin. They could just as easily and more accurately translate Matthew 28:1 as after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was about to begin. And it would have been an entirely accurate translation. But they're holding so strongly to their tradition of Good Friday and Easter that they translate it as at dawn. The first day of the week comes from the Greek mia sabbaton, meaning the first of the Sabbaths. And it's commonly understood that this means the day after the weekly Sabbath. So it would be clearer, it would be easier to understand this passage if it were stated that late on the Sabbath, as the first of the week was starting. See, Matthew's not talking about a Sunday morning resurrection here. The difference in the time that he's speaking of and the time that the translators are implying literally is the difference between night and day. When we compare Matthew 28, Mark 16, Luke 24, and John 20, we put the events together, we can prove that Jesus rose before a Sunday sunrise. So what happens on the first day of the week before sunrise? We see that Matthew 28:2, the tomb is opened. The Sabbath has ended. The women are resenting. The women come to see the tomb. They see a guard there. There's not much more they can do. They turn around. They leave. Shortly, right after that, or at some point after that, it's still dark, there's an earthquake. The stone is rolled away, and there's an angel suddenly appearing. Now imagine if you're a guard in this tomb and you see this. You're not going to hang around. You're leaving. So now the tomb is opened. But think about this. If the body of Jesus was still in the tomb, would the angels be rolling it open and opening it up? No. The tomb was open so that people could see that, no, he's not there anymore. He's risen. He's left the grave just as he promised. While it's still dark, but now getting closer to morning, we see in Luke 24, verses 1 through 3. Now on the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they and certain other women with them came to the tomb bringing the spices which they had prepared. But they found the stone rolled away from the tomb, and they went in and did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. John tells us that while it was still dark was when they started to head towards the tomb. Still dark, they're heading towards the tomb, and they get there. It's starting to get light. It's getting towards sunrise. They can see this, and they see the tomb is opened up. Mary Magdalene apparently did not actually go in the tomb with the other women, but instead she leaves, goes back to tell Peter and John, the tomb's open. We don't know what's happened here to his body. While she's doing that, the other women go into the tomb. And the angel there is telling them, Jesus has already risen just as he foretold. Mary gets back to Peter and John. They can't believe what they're hearing, so they take off running to come back to the tomb to see what's going on. She also follows them, but obviously she's not running like they are. She can't keep up with them. Meanwhile, while they're coming back to the tomb, the other women have been told by the angel, he's not here, he's risen, go tell his disciples. So they leave and start to head back into Jerusalem to tell the disciples. As they leave, Peter and John arrive. John comes running, he gets there first. He stops at the tomb, he doesn't want to go in. Peter gets there. As Peter does, he just barrels right in. He goes in, he checks it out, John follows him in. They don't see the body. They see the linens there, neatly folded and laid out. They don't see the body. They don't know what's going on. They don't remember yet that he told them he would rise from the grave. So they're leaving. As they leave, of course, Mary Magdalene now gets back here, and she's here by herself. There's no one else. And that brings us to Mark 16:9. A lot of people claim that Mark 16:9 proves that Jesus rose at sunrise and he appeared to Mary Magdalene as he rose. But does it? No. Mark 16:9. Now when he rose early in the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven demons. Okay, let's have an English lesson here. What's the subject of this sentence? The subject is him appearing to Mary Magdalene. It's not when he arose. That's in a clause. That's talking about something else. The main subject of this sentence is appearing to Mary. King James Version, now when Jesus was risen early in the first day of the week. So what time frame is Mark referring to in this verse? Well, the first day of the week is not the same Greek expression as what was used in Matthew. Mark here uses the expression protos sabbaton. Now, the word protos is the same root that we find in our word prototype. And what is a prototype? Prototype is the very first of something. So when the Greek word protos is used in reference to time, it's talking about the very head or the very beginning of that time period. So Mark's speaking about the beginning of the week. When is the beginning of the week? It's not Sunday. It's not midnight. We're talking about the Hebrew calendar system, the Jewish calendar system. The beginning of the week is at sunset. A lot of people overlook that. They don't realize that, so they think beginning of the week, oh, it must be Sunday. But in addition to using the expression proto-sabbaton, we also see the word early here. Now, that's translated from the Greek word proi, which is P-R-O-I. We translate that as early. Those two words, used in combination, mean the earliest portion of the beginning of the week. And what is the earliest portion of the beginning of the week? It says the sun is setting. So what Mark is telling us here, a better, more literal, accurate translation should be, and having risen early at the beginning of the week, i.e. sundown, the night before, he first appeared to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out seven demons. Mark is talking about the exact same time frame, exact period that Matthew was talking about, sunset at the end of the Sabbath. The one other area that we look at, which a lot of people point to justification for using parts of days, is on the road to Emmaus. Later that day, on Sunday, Luke 24:13-24. I'm not going to read the whole section here, but we've got the two of the disciples who are out walking. They're on their way to Emmaus, and they're discussing everything that's been going on because it's been a crazy day. What a week they were having. The one they thought who was going to redeem Israel ended up being killed. He's put in the grave. He said he was going to rise, but we haven't seen him. And now some members of our group, some women, say that they saw him. He's not in the tomb. They're not sure what is happening here. But let's take a look at a key verse here. Verse 19, the stranger who joins them on their walk is talking to him, and he said to them, "What things?" Because they're talking about all these things that happened. And they said to him, "The things concerning Jesus Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty indeed, and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. And indeed, besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened." Boom. They latch on to that expression. Well, today is the third day since these happened. Well, obviously, they said he couldn't have been crucified on Wednesday because Sunday would be the fifth day. That's their line of reasoning. But again, let's take a look at a couple things here. Number one, all these things also includes the time that the Pharisees went into Pilate and requested a guard. So that adds a considerable amount of time after Jesus was actually buried. But even more critically, let's look at the phrase here, "Today is the third day since these things happened." As we look at the Greek here, the word that we translate into "since" comes from the Greek word apo. And basically, that word means away from or off from. The The intermediate Greek-English lexicon says that when that word is used as part of a time reference, it means away from that time reference. So another way of translating this would actually be, as they were talking to Jesus, telling him about this, today is after the third day since these things were done. And since Jesus had promised he would rise the third day, they're still a little confused because they haven't seen him. They've heard stories, but they don't know for a fact. And they're wondering, well, today is after the third day. You know, what's happening here? It's not the third day since. It's after the third day. In other words, it's the fourth day since the last of these events happened. And the last of those events was the Pharisees asking Pilate for guards. So that brings us back to the question. How do you get 3 days and three nights from Friday sunset to Sunday morning? Well, there's a simple answer. You don't. Jesus said he'd be in the grave 3 days and three nights. And we believe he meant a full 3 days and three nights. The Bible provides sufficient evidence to support that belief and to support the literal interpretation of the sign that Jesus gave. And to understand that it doesn't require some outside source to create this strained definition of parts of days or whole days, and if you do this and you do that, it's a very simple explanation. Jesus said what he meant, and that's what we believe. Jesus was put in the tomb on Wednesday evening at sunset, and he left the grave around sunset on Saturday, just as he said, 3 days and three nights.